Seattle, you just got warned. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. About an hour ago, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions told so-called sanctuary cities like Seattle what actions the White House will take against them.
I strongly urge our nation's states and cities and counties to consider carefully the harm they are doing to their citizens by refusing to enforce our immigration laws and to rethink these policies. Such policies make their cities and states less safe and put them at risk of losing federal dollars.
For some context here, we're joined by Liz Jones, reporter with KUOW's immigration team. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
We just heard some of what the Attorney General said. Overall, what's the news today coming from Jeff Sessions?
Well, he's mostly talking about so-called sanctuary cities and certain funding that could be at risk if they don't comply with federal laws and specifically some pieces of immigration law. He mentioned specific law enforcement grants that have been mentioned before. They've come under scrutiny by Congress, and for many years in the past, these specific law enforcement grants have been targeted. Sessions specifically said there's $4.1 billion in federal grants this year that could be at stake. And he's saying he's urging states and local jurisdictions to review their policies to make sure they're in compliance with this piece of the immigration law. The specific law he called out is one that says that you cannot in any way prohibit or restrict the exchange of information about someone's citizenship or immigration status. So he also mentioned the detainer report that we saw come out last week. This is part of something that was called for in an immigration order in January from President Trump. And it's basically kind of being called a name and shame list. It's the federal government citing local jurisdictions that don't follow through on ICE immigration enforcement requests to hold people in jail for a longer period so that ICE can come and potentially take custody of these individuals. Some jurisdictions say we're not going to do these extra holds because they're unconstitutional. Jeff Sessions did mention that report again as without much specific, but maybe indicating that's a way they're going to try and figure out who is in violation or who they consider to be in violation of these federal laws.
And there are many jurisdictions in Washington state that don't cooperate with federal immigration agents the way the White House would like them to. You were telling me that, in a sense, the state is under a kind of definition, you could consider the state a sanctuary state or a welcoming state.
Right. If they have like a don't ask, don't tell policy, the feds might see that as a frustrating piece of law enforcement, that they want local jurisdictions asking for that information and then sharing it later.
Okay, so the White House has been warning for a while that it was going to take some action against these so-called sanctuary cities and jurisdictions. The mayor of Seattle, Ed Murray, has said, well, we're going full speed ahead. We're not going to be bullied. We're going to risk any of that federal money. So today's announcement from Jeff Sessions, is that any different from what the Trump administration has been warning of all along?
It's really similar in the intent of the warning. It's a more narrow in scope, though. I think the way that he's looking at these specific law enforcement grants, and we're starting to see specific language change in how these grants, how the guidelines work for these grants. For example, there's a grant called, it's called the SCAP grant, but what it does is it reimburses local jails if they hold undocumented immigrants. So like King County Jail will apply for reimbursement for people that they held. The guidelines on that now are asking these local jurisdictions, local jails, to certify that they're in compliance with these laws. This is a new level of certification that they're being asked to do. So we're seeing some language change there. The detainer forms themselves, Immigration and Customs Enforcement just announced on Friday that they're changing these forms. The previous form said very clearly at the top, this is a voluntary request for information. That word voluntary is now gone. I've got a question into ICE to see, is this required now? Is this voluntary? And we haven't heard back yet. But we're seeing language change that could lead to something more clear about what is a violation, what is perceived as a violation of federal law, and how are jurisdictions complying or not complying. And we should point out, jurisdictions have said we are following the letter of the law in the way that we go through with these, we honor these detainers or don't honor these detainers. For example, Snohomish County last week, when they got called out in this detainer report, said, serve us, if you find probable cause to hold somebody, give us a warrant. Come in here with a warrant. They said they had no warrants from ICE to hold people, but if they do, they'll hold them.
So bottom line, how much federal money is at stake here in Seattle now?
In Seattle, I haven't done the numbers on Seattle, but let's say, for example, one of these grants, the reimbursement grant for jails, that's calculated on a state and a county level. In Washington State last year, we got about $1 million. So annually, about $1 million for Washington State on that grant alone. King County, about the same amount, about $900,000 last year. So it's significant money, and I don't know the exact total. And if they target more than just these law enforcement grants, that's still a question, too.
Any reaction so far today from local officials?
Yeah, we talked to King County Sheriff John Urquhart, and he said this doesn't change a thing for me, that this is what the administration has been saying all along. It's nothing new, just because it came from AG Jeff Sessions. We also heard from Debbie Wagner, and she's a Burien City Council member. And back in January, she voted against Burien adopting the sanctuary designation. She said the Burien Police Department already has a policy in place that officers can't ask about immigration status. But Debbie Wagner told us today that by adopting the sanctuary label, Burien set itself up to be a target, and it may come back to bite them. But then again, it's unlikely, or it seems unlikely, that the administration would go after the mere label of sanctuary city. It would be a pattern or a practice or a policy that they would have to find in violation.
Reporter Liz Jones with KUOW's immigration team on the announcement today from the U.S. Attorney General on what the White House intends to do about so-called sanctuary cities, sanctuary jurisdictions. Liz, thanks a lot for that.
You're welcome, Bill.
And we put a call into the mayor's office and Mayor Seattle Murray's, Seattle Mayor Ed Murray's office, and they said they're not ready for a conversation yet, but they're putting together a statement on this today as well. Back in a moment with more of KUOW's The Record. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Continuing in the news now, what's going to happen to your health care? Last week, after Republicans in Congress didn't get enough votes to replace President Obama's Affordable Care Act, President Trump predicted disaster for people who buy health insurance.
I've been saying for the last year and a half that the best thing we can do, politically speaking, is let Obamacare explode. It is exploding right now. It's many states have big problems. Almost all states have big problems.
Obamacare is exploding. Many states have big problems. Is that true? Is it true nationally? And what about here in Washington State? Here's the guy to ask. Aaron Katz teaches health policy in the UW School of Public Health. Welcome back, Aaron.
Good to see you, Bill.
Is Obamacare exploding nationally?
No.
Thanks for coming. What do you mean? Why does he say
nationally or locally? I think what he's referring to is our problems that we see in the individual market. So remembering that most people get insurance at their place of work, their employer, or through a program like Medicare or Medicaid. 10% or less of us get insurance by going out into the marketplace and buying individual insurance.
About how many in Washington State?
Oh, gosh. I think there's, 10% of, that's a few hundred thousand people.
Okay.
So it's not nobody.
Mm-hmm.
So the real people facing some issues in that market, less so in this state.
Meaning
so,
what? Premiums are rising?
Premiums
choices
rising,
are shrinking?
Exactly. But in this state, premiums actually have been fairly moderate. So in the last year, they've only gone up about 8% on average. And before that, I think it was 4 or 6%. And we have to remember that before the Affordable Care Act, those premiums were going up 40, 50, even 100% a year before the law. So, but in some places around the country, premiums have gone up a lot, in a few places more than 100%. And in a fair number of counties around the country, again, not so much here in Washington State, people only have a choice of one. They don't really have a choice. They have one insurance provider available. Again, just as perspective, it's important to remember that in some states, before the Affordable Care Act, there was only one insurance provider in the individual market.
What about rural Washington State? Yes, we have a nest of options in greater Seattle area, but this is a state-by-state system. What about rural Washington State?
Right. In the majority of counties in this state, Residents have a choice of at least a couple of insurance options. There are a few states where the options are quite narrow, and that is a problem. So if you're going to rely on a marketplace of insurance, you want a fair number of options.
Why is our market in Washington relatively robust compared to your Kentuckys and Arizonas and Tennessees?
We have a long history of fairly strong regulation of the insurance market here, and we have an insurance commissioner's office that has been very proactive in trying to make sure that insurance companies are able to provide a wide range of options and remain solvent. Commissioner Kreidler has worked very hard on that. And I think we have a state in general that has a very strong bipartisan commitment to making the Affordable Care Act work here. So you have that leadership from the top as well.
Okay, so relatively well off in Washington. Let's go back for a moment to the national scene. Let's say Obamacare in general is troubled. What would need to be fixed from the White House or from Congress?
Well, I think...
let's say the White House, because we're sticking with Obamacare for now.
Right. So I think there are a couple things. If we were trying to fix the problems that we see, particularly in the individual market, so we're focusing on that. One is we'd probably want to greatly increase the subsidies that lower-income people have. And the reason for that is that some lower-income people... would really like to have insurance, but their incomes just aren't enough, even with the existing subsidies. Others have they do buy insurance, but the insurance they buy on these insurance exchanges have very high deductibles. So for them to be able to buy an insurance policy that actually doesn't require them to pay the first $2,500 or $5,000, we probably have to increase the insurance subsidies.
But that's not coming from the Trump White House. That's not going to happen, right?
Well, you asked me what would fix a real problem. Yeah. That's the kind of thing that would fix a real problem.
Okay. What about in Washington State? Let's say if we wanted to improve the situation, and Trump keeps saying it's going to get worse. In any case, in Washington, what could our state do to improve health care coverage?
Well, likewise, one way to improve that individual market is for the state to provide its own subsidies on top of the federal subsidies that will allow lower income people to buy better insurance on the exchanges. So that's one thing that could happen. I mean, the state could also look at banning on the insurance marketplace the highest deductible plans, because my worry is that people are relatively healthy. They buy these plans that have low premiums but high deductibles. If they start needing health care, they find out that, oh, I've got to pay the first $3,000-$4,000. Next year, I'm just going to drop coverage. It's cheaper for me to put the money in the bank and pay for care when I get it. And that erodes the insurance pool, because you need healthy people in that pool to subsidize people who need services.
Well, what if you're from a part of Washington State that's red, you're a small government fiscal conservative lawmaker, and you don't want to either raise government subsidies or tell insurance companies what to do?
Then you're in a dilemma. I mean, the question is, ultimately, do you want people to have access to health care when they need it? And I think the Republicans in Congress have found that if that's a goal, and you want a competitive marketplace of insurance companies to help meet that goal, then there's a balancing act. You can't have no government in that scenario. Government has to play a role in subsidizing coverage and in regulating that marketplace. So that's the choice that you have to make.
Okay, final question. We've been talking about the state healthcare exchange. Will Washington State, could you imagine the state just expanding Medicaid, government-funded healthcare?
Well, actually—
Seriously expanding it.
Yeah, well, the state has expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act.
With a lot of help from the federal government.
Of course, with a lot of help from the federal government. And I would say that's one of the dangers of the next sort of battle lines is that, I mean, Speaker Ryan has made it clear for decades that one of his interests is to make Medicaid a block grant program, which he threatened in the bill that was in the House of Representatives that didn't pass. But I would expect that he'll come back with that proposal as a standalone. This state would have a dilemma because we've made a huge commitment, not only under the Affordable Care Act, but for years before that, that Medicaid is an important program and we want to make it work for people.
We've been talking about this, about Obamacare, the questionable explosion thereof, and what Washington State can do, with Aaron Katz, who teaches health policy in the University of Washington School of Public Health. Good to see you again. We come back soon?
You bet, Bill. Thanks.
Okay. KUOW is the record. Now we want to go to the front lines of healthcare delivery, because joining us by phone, we have Ann Newcomb, a nurse at Harborview, clinical director for emergency services there. Ann, welcome to KUOW.
Hi, good afternoon.
Will you paint us a picture from your perspective? What is happening in the Harborview emergency room on an average day?
Yes. So really, if we go back to previously with the Affordable Care Act, we were really seeing a large number of patients coming through that didn't have any coverage. So one of the biggest advantages of the Affordable Care Act is that our mission population, particularly our poor and underserved, now have coverage. And that is a significant piece for these patients. So we didn't see a large jump in numbers of patients coming through. What we saw was the fact that they actually had some coverage.
So the Affordable Care Act apparently will stay as is for now, but both Democrats and Republicans have said that the ACA, Obamacare, needs reform. So what kind of reforms would help in the emergency room?
Well, I think very similar to what Aaron mentioned previously is really encouraging, insurance with those high deductibles to get some reduction in that. The things that we're really faced in the emergency department is that we are traditionally the front door for the poor to healthcare. So we want to make sure, and we've invested a lot in the past few years in really getting our patients onto programs. We have financial counselors at Harborview and our other UW Medicine hospitals to get people coverage. Because, as I say, the emergency department tends to be the front door, but we really want people to get primary health care so that there really is a continuity of care and really establishing a relationship with providers. That's key. The preventative care and primary care is key to this solution, and we need to increase that.
Finally, Anne, everyone I know, no matter where you work, you have something that you wish the general public understood about what you see every day. What's number one thing about emergency rooms that you feel like the rest of us would benefit from knowing about?
That's a great question. I think really just for the public to be prepared and know that we are prepared in the emergency department. So we have an amazing staff, high-skilled physicians and nurses and others. We're there to serve the public, and we serve our mission public here at Harborview. So take care, and I have to say, wear your seatbelt.
Wear your seatbelt. Thank you, Ann Newcomb. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
She's a nurse at Harborview and clinical director for emergency services there. And we've been talking today about where healthcare is headed with or without a replacement for the Affordable Care Act. More of KUOW's The Record, including addiction, but addiction to the gadget, coming up. A Catholic bishop is preaching a message that some of his white parishioners don't like. They have to love their undocumented immigrant neighbors. Correspondent Anna King has our story from Grandview in Central Washington.
Are you still with me?
Bishop Joseph Tyson is the head of the Diocese of Yakima that stretches across seven counties, most of central Washington. He says more than 70% of Catholic churchgoers here are Latino. Among the adults, he says most are undocumented. And he's telling everyone the bottom line in central Washington is this.
If you want to protect the unborn, you have to walk through the doors of the undocumented.
70 people are here at Blessed Sacrament in Grandview. It's part of a tour Bishop Tyson's doing. He's already spoken to crowds in Richland, Yakima, Moses Lake, Ellensburg, and East Wenatchee. On this night, there are 7 round tables of Latinos and 1 of all white people at the back.
Here, Central Washington is a pretty pro-life environment.
Bishop Tyson explains a change he wants to see in that pro-life culture. He starts by pointing out,
most of our pregnancies are on the Spanish side.
He says 80 to 90% of Catholic babies baptized in Central Washington are Latino. Then he says pro-life volunteers in his diocese have been successful in helping women have those babies, but that most of the families they're helping have some undocumented members. And here's his punchline. All Catholics have the responsibility to help those babies and their families.
I know in the national debate, that's like two different moral universes, red issue, blue issue. Huh? But here in Central Washington, we live a different reality.
In Central Washington, that reality includes fear of immigration raids and deportation. Tyson says those fears and what he calls racist rhetoric undermine the Catholic pro-life mission. After the bishop's talk, snacks are served. Cookies, veggies. The Latinos stay for fellowship. The whites hit the doors. Sitting in a wooden pew at the back of the auditorium, Bishop Tyson looks over the remaining people.
We're teaching about God in a distracted classroom right now. That might be a way of looking at it.
And he says often white people in his parishes don't ask questions during his talks. They write emails afterwards.
The pushback is usually underground. And some of it can be pretty severe, where I can think, glad you didn't say this, you know. It's better we're doing this offline.
They say things like, they should be afraid and go back to Mexico with the rest of them. Stephanie Dahl went to Tyson's talk in Richland. She was into it, but as a white person in a mostly white crowd, she says her agreement with the bishop put her in the minority.
I felt the need to nod my head a lot to convey my agreement and understanding with the bishop.
What made you feel that way?
There were a lot of still faces and not a lot of other head nods happening around the table and around the room.
Maria Perez feels the divide at Blessed Sacrament in Grandview. Some whites in her parish always say hi. Others, she says, they just pass by me, like I'm nothing. Bishop Tyson told his Grandview Latino followers it can be hard to face racist or unfriendly white people, but it's God's work. He also told them that in Central Washington, things have changed so much that sometimes white people can feel like outsiders. So Tyson says Latinos in Central Washington need to flip the script of a Catholic story that goes back centuries.
So English speakers, the Spanish speakers are going to be learning how can they be better missionaries to you in the North.
He says opening doors and hearts will take love, and it may also take some steamy pozole. I'm Anna King in Grandview, Washington.
This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. How far away is your phone from you right now? Do you always keep it close at hand? Check it first thing in the morning? Have you increased your data plan lately? If your phone buzzed right now, would you quit listening to me? Would you stop paying attention to a loved one? Okay, maybe that's not you. You're not addicted to your phone. Now let's talk about Facebook, Hulu, Amazon Prime, websites, podcasts, texting, and your email inbox. You almost can't help being addicted. I guess that's what addiction is. But there is something you can do about it, says our next guest, author of Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. He teaches marketing and psychology at NYU. He's speaking tonight at Town Hall Seattle at 7:30. Adam Alter, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
You know something about irresistibility because you yourself got hooked on a game called Flappy Bird?
Yeah, I did. This was a couple of years ago. The game came out and a few friends had downloaded it and they told me to try it. And it was fascinating. I started playing the game and it was incredibly straightforward. It's just a little bird that flies through obstacles. And I started playing and I played and I played. And I found that once I began, the sessions, instead of being half an hour long, would become an hour, two, three. And I wasn't alone. A lot of people had the same issue with this game.
What was so special about it?
No one really knows. What happens that's interesting about this game is that every time your character flies into a wall, which happens, it just starts up again. And you don't even notice that's happened. What it basically does is it eradicates your stopping rules. Those are the rules that step in that tell you it's time to stop doing this one thing and get on to the next thing. And Flappy Bird is just an amazing vehicle for this sort of addictive experience because there are no stopping rules. The minute you start, nothing tells you that it's time to stop.
I'm writing that phrase down. That's great. Eradicates your stopping rules.
Right.
Okay, so all's good so far. You love it. You have a game and you're a satisfied customer. Then what?
Yeah, so that's the interesting thing, right? If you're designing games, that's sort of the holy grail here. At one point, the designer, who was a guy from Vietnam who was designing a whole lot of indie games, he'd never experienced success like this. He earned $500,000 a week in ad revenue. So he was happy. But for me, it started to encroach on my ability to work. My relationship with my wife suffered. I stopped spending as much time with friends. So it really started to take the place of other things that I should have been doing. And a lot of people said the same thing. I started to look online at the reviews for the game, and they were fascinating. There were these ambivalent reviews of like 5 stars, and next to the 5 stars, it would be The Death of Me,
yeah.
Title of the review.
We need a hate star.
It's a hate star, but it's 5 hate stars.
Yeah.
People feel fantastic about the game when they're playing, but also terrible about it because it really eats into other parts of their lives.
And the game developer saw that reaction, and then what?
It was amazing. I've never seen anything like this. He's earning $500,000 a week, and he decides to pull it from the market. He says, in 22 hours on Twitter, in 22 hours, I'm going to pull this game from the market. You won't be able to play it anymore. And of course, this is where the analogy to drug dealing comes in. He's pulling his product from the market, and people, thousands of them, start tweeting at him saying, you must have a copy available. Surely you can just send one to me through email or something like that. And he has to then tweet, don't ask me, I have no copies left. And so all these people are going into withdrawal because they can no longer play this game. It was absolutely—
It almost sounds like a marketing trick. Did he really pull the game?
Not only did he pull the game, but he vowed that the next game he created would be less addictive because he felt so bad about it.
Wow. And then you started learning that really well-known tech developers were wary.
Yeah, this is fascinating to me. Just the difference between what people were saying about their own products publicly and how they were using them at home and what they were doing when it came to their kids. So the classic case was Steve Jobs, who had obviously lauded all the products that Apple was churning out, but he wouldn't let his kids near them. Hmm. So the iPad was the one classic example. There was a journalist who approached him and said, your kids must love the iPad. And he said, they've never used it. We don't allow it in the home. And he is just one of dozens of tech experts who say the same thing.
There's a no tech school in the Bay Area.
There is. 75% of the kids at this school are the kids of CEOs, tech execs. And their parents have chosen to send them somewhere where they will not be exposed to tech.
We're talking with the author of Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked, Adam Alters at Town Hall Seattle this evening. A colleague has a question, Adam. I'm playing this game called Infinity Blade 2 on my phone, and I need another 300,000 gold pieces so I can buy the Infinity Blade to fight the Dark Fiend and unlock the Vile Shield. I just put Zootopia on. That's good for 90 minutes, but after that, the kids have swimming lessons and the Wi-Fi at the pool is terrible. What am I supposed to do?
I think I understood about a third of the words there.
But you got the idea.
I got the idea, though. Yeah. No, I've heard similar things before. You know what you've got to do is basically we are terrible at resisting temptation when temptation is at hand. What you have to do is you have to say there are X periods of the day, say 3 periods of the day between 1 and 2 p.m., 3 and 4 p.m., 6 and 7 p.m. Those are times when I will not have screens nearby.
But wait a minute, Adam, let me challenge you. Why is this a problem? If you're happy, I mean, you said you didn't like how it was affecting your relationship with your wife, et cetera. But what if you're just having a good time? The online world is enjoyable. My kids don't need 100% of my attention. You could argue kids get more attention than they need. Like, are you sure this is a problem for everybody who's addicted?
No. Well, that's the thing. The definition of addiction is something that you keep doing compulsively because you want to do it. But in the long term, it has negative effects on some aspect of your well-being. Oh. Usually it's social. It can be physical. It can be psychological. You could be spending too much money, so it can become financial. If you can genuinely say that your usage of the smartphone or the game you play or whatever it is that you're doing is not bad for you, not harmful, then it's not an addiction. Then it's just a passion, and it's a pleasurable, positive passion rather than a negative one.
Okay.
So I don't think that would be a problem if that's truly the case.
Okay. But if you do feel addicted, you started talking about setting aside windows of time.
Yeah, that's, I think, the easiest thing to do if you're talking about the consumer perspective is just to say that I use too much of this thing. It's making me feel bad.
Can an addicted person do that? purposely walk away from the addictive substance? I thought that's what addiction is.
Yeah, well, that is addiction. But I think any addicted person goes through a withdrawal process, and this you'll experience this. If you think about leaving home and you've dropped your phone on the sidewalk just as you leave the home, you know that you feel terrible about that for a while. But then the day wears on, you start to forget about it. You're past the withdrawal and tolerance process, and you start to feel good again. So what happens initially when you use these strategies is you feel bad. And then when you talk to people, and I do this quite often, I'll say, so how do you feel now that 2 or 3 weeks have passed? And they start to say, pretty good. I feel like I've left this thing behind that used to shackle me, and I feel much better about my life now.
Interesting. And if we don't have that, for some reason, can't do it on our own, the interesting thing in your book is you talk about what companies and tech gadget makers ought to do. So yeah. What are some of those ideas?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of tricks and tools they use to make the products they sell maximally addictive. Now, they would never describe it that way. As far as they're concerned, the best product is one that you use in preference to all other products. But unfortunately, what they're doing with a lot of the products they're creating is they're testing them to within an inch of their lives. And so what they end up designing or sending out into the world is that sort of 10th generation that's evolved from the original product, and now this one is a weaponized, impossible to resist version of the original one.
It will eradicate your stopping rules.
You will not
as you
have
said.
A stopping rule available that will step in, and that's a lot of what happens, especially with games, which are tested heavily to the point where people are sitting there for, as they do with slot machines in casinos, they just sit for hours on end, and there's nothing that says to them it's time to move on.
What could manufacturers do about that, and designers?
Yeah, well, I think I've heard a few things. First of all, a lot of them don't even ask these questions. And so one thing they need to do is know this is an issue. Turns out the products you're sending out there can be bad for people. If you
should they think of themselves as big tobacco? I mean, this basically the same thing?
Yeah, I think in some respects, obviously they're not killing people. And so I think we should dial it back a little bit from there. But I think it's a useful analogy because essentially, yes, if you are producing a product that's causing a lot of people negative effects, negative consequences, it's affecting their lives negatively, then I think there are certain questions that should be asked. And one person, for example, has suggested a Hippocratic oath. So just as doctors ask themselves, am I doing above all no harm to my patients? They should ask, you know, essentially what tech is about is making our lives better. It should be making us happier, more efficient perhaps. It should connect people. And if we're not doing that with our products and what we're essentially doing is keeping them isolated by pushing them into this place where they can't stop, then perhaps we should consider slight tweaks and redesigns that fix that problem.
You know, you're talking to a lot of local companies and developers right now, yes?
Absolutely.
On Seattle Radio. Okay, so why would do you really foresee these designers making their product purposely less desirable? Honestly, is that going to happen?
No, probably not. Here's one thing that could happen, though. As the norms evolve, and they seem to be evolving in the direction where consumers are starting to request more friendly tech that's consistent with what they want from their lives, it's possible that they'll start to demand this, just as now they demand a lot of green marketing, green products from companies that are aware of what they're doing to the environment. They might start to demand that companies pay a little more attention to what their products are doing in a very big sort of cultural way. What sort of effect is your product having on the world? And I think this will be a new dimension. It's not just about saving the environment with my products and not polluting the world. It's also about creating products that make people happier, better off, and bring them together rather than keep them apart.
I haven't noticed that trend yet. I mean, do you think I see the trend, the signs that we're addicted? I see and I participate in the gadget use in traffic and on and on and on and around my kids and all that. I'm a bad person. But I haven't yet seen a trend that we are agreeing that, oh, we're addicted and this is hurting our relationships and we're going to demand change from these companies.
Well, that's why I write the book, because I think that's what's starting to happen is people are starting to have those conversations. They are not happening in large companies that produce the tech yet. I think it's a thing that's worth at least considering. You know, there may even be products that benefit everyone, and this is the newest thing that I'm starting to think about. Perhaps you could have a slightly less weaponized version of a product. Think of the food industry. You've got 100 calorie packs of foods. People are paying food companies a lot of money to get less food because what they're really doing is they're outsourcing their self-control. They're saying, I'll pay you to give me less food because I know I can't stop myself. Maybe people will do
that. You mean small snack-sized versions of things?
Exactly, yeah. Small snack-sized.
What would that be in the gadget world?
It might be say, say Facebook, for example, a lot of people return over and over again to their posts because they see the numbers climbing, likes, shares, comments, and so on. There's now a demetricated app that you can plug into Facebook, which takes away all the numbers and people spend less time with it. Now, imagine Facebook released a demetricated version that people spend less time on. And they basically say, we know you don't want to sign off completely because you've got a lot of good friends on here, but here's a version. You pay us $5 or $10 a year. We'll give you this slightly different version. You'll be happier. We get revenue. And, you know, I'm a little queasy about suggesting that because it seems a little, it's like, that doesn't feel quite kosher to me.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know. I think the idea that you say to these companies, what you're doing is bad for people. Why don't you just charge them and then they'll pay you and then it'll be less bad for them? It seems a little weird that you have to extract money from people to give them a less bad version of the program.
Mm-hmm.
But the benefit of this as a sort of first step is that at least it works for everyone. It's revenue for the companies. People are better off. And it's not a huge amount of money for most people, the most people who use these products.
But are you saying that in the meantime, there is a plug-in that works with Facebook, like, and Facebook can't stop this from happening? You can plug in something that takes away that totaling up of your shares and likes and stuff?
Yeah, it's called the Facebook Demetricator. Huh. I believe it exists at the moment. I don't know. Maybe it won't exist tomorrow, but yeah. It certainly seems to exist today.
They put warning signs on the iPads with a Mr. Yuck. And TV ads cannot show people using their phone, kind of like alcohol ads.
Right.
What about... you know, Seattle, we're talking about possibly taxing sugary sodas. Mm-hmm. Is there some government analogy possible here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think of virtual reality, for example. I think that's a potential public health crisis because you're going to have people who are deciding between the imperfect, complex real world at any moment and face-to-face conversations and just escaping to this perfect virtual world. And that's... I've spoke to someone who works in this world. She's an expert in virtual reality tech. She said to me, this is a public health crisis, much as sugary sodas are. You end up having to tax sugary sodas or tax people who buy them because you basically know that for the collective good, that needs to happen. You need to make them less attractive, make them more expensive. I think we may need similar legislation at some point that preserves the public well-being. It's maybe the only way. That's a heavier-handed approach.
I've heard that the governments in some countries require companies to, for example, protect workers from email outside of work hours.
Yeah. So in France, if you have a company that's got more than 50 employees now, the rule is that there has to be a charter. You bring together the heads of the company and the employees, and they agree that this is the way we're going to deal with email. And a lot of them say, for example, that we withhold emails between 6 p.m. and 8 a.m., so that if you go home and you want to get a break, you have no choice. Some of them do it on vacation as well. So Daimler, the car company in
Germany.
Yeah, so they have the same sort of approach where the day you go on vacation, if anyone sends you an email, they get an automatic message that says, this email is being deleted. You can pass it along to someone else. Here's someone else. Or you can resend it when this person's back in the office. And that means that instead of checking email incessantly when you're on vacation, you can leave your inbox alone because it's not going to look any different when you get back from the vacation. People say it's a huge thing for their well-being.
I don't know if some of these government solutions are going to fit our American culture here. We have just started to get into it, and that's our time for now, talking with the author of Irresistible, The Rise of Addicted Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. NYU psychology and marketing professor Adam Alter will be at Town Hall, Seattle, tonight at 7:30. It's been fascinating talking with you, Adam. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
KUOW's The Record, back in just a moment. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Last week, we were talking about paid family leave with Republican Washington State Senator Joe Fain from Auburn. Senator Fain is a new dad, and he's got some sympathy for families who need more time to bond with children or to care for sick loved ones. So he's sponsoring a bill that would require employers in our state to offer paid family leave. Well, that discussion inspired a listener to share an exchange she had with another state senator. Social media producer Bond Huberman, will you tell us the story?
Hey, Bill. Okay, so this scene begins in January.
Right. But January. Imagine it's even rainier and colder. Go ahead.
Amanda emails her state senator, Mark Mullett. He's a Democrat representing Issaquah, Carnation, North Bend. and she wanted him to support that state bill requiring paid leave to care for a new child or, again, a sick family member.
And Senator Mullet wrote back explaining why he doesn't plan to vote for the bill, and he wrote, "At my pizza restaurant, I give my employees a set number of paid leave days every year. I think a policy like that would be fairer to employees and employers and easier to administer. Somebody who stays healthy all year also deserves paid time off." And then to reassure Amanda, he added, "We may disagree on this issue, but as your senator, I will always give you a straight answer."
And after reading that, Amanda says she was, quote, steaming mad. Mm-hmm. She wrote to us, quote, "Senator Mullet clearly doesn't understand what family leave is. To argue that people should use their accrued leave for family leave is ridiculous. And as an employer, he should know that."
Now, Amanda has not yet written to Senator Mullet. I'd like to invite him on the show to hear more about that perspective. Okay, Senator Mullet, we'll try to hook up that interview. And I'd like to hear your perspective. What is your outlook on paid family leave? Do you have an excellent paid family leave situation that everybody should be copying? Are you an employer who grapples with this question for your workers? Please talk to us. Write to record@kuow.org. You can tweet us at KUOW. You can leave a phone message at 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663. The little town of Black Diamond in southeastern King County has about 4,000 people in it. There's a development going on that will quadruple the town. The residents and the government have been harshly divided over this. Reporters Joshua McNichols and Carolyn Adolph are on KUOW's Region of Boom team. And Joshua told me how they learned about this bitter fight in Black Diamond. It was a newspaper photo of a city council meeting.
The photo shows two gray-haired women fighting over a gavel. One is a city council member, and she's seated, and she's raising her gavel like she's about to pound it. And the other is the mayor, who's kind of crouched over her behind her and is reaching over her head to sort of wrestle the gavel out of her hands. Our producer found this picture in a local paper, and we all looked at it and thought, what the heck is going on?
What is happening? And you have spent a month basically reporting on the backstory to that photograph. So, Carolyn, what is going on there?
Two things. The first one is, of course, this massive development going on in town, which has been very divisive and very controversial. People have had 20 years to worry about the price that they're going to pay as a community for having a development this large. 6,000 houses, Bill. That's what's going to go in there, and there's only 1,400 houses now.
Mm-hmm.
So the voters elected some people who wanted to make the development smaller, but instead of whittling away at the development, they ended up kind of whittling away at each other. There's this massive battle. And the second thing is, of course, that massive political crisis ground city government to a halt and could have actually forced the city shutdown. What it really was in the end was a strict battle for control.
A battle, and you dropped into the middle of it. And what was that like trying to report that?
Oh, man. You know, we sort of had this feeling as we're so clever, we're going to go Black Diamond, and nobody knows about Black Diamond. But every time I come called a government official with a hypothetical question about what would happen if such and such a city did such and such, they'd go, oh, the Black Diamond question. Just a second, let me get you our expert.
Mm-hmm. And any time we try to report on some little thing, people would just send us encyclopedias full of information and court documents and things like that.
Baggage, baggage, baggage. That's ack. Right.
And it was never really about just Black Diamond. You were there to learn something about the growth of this region, the development here. What did you learn?
Well, the fascinating thing about Black Diamond is, you know, there's growth happening all over the place, all over the region. But in Black Diamond, you can kind of see it all at once, right? And you can see how a project, a big development project like this can overwhelm not only the infrastructure and the roads and the traffic it'll cause, but it can overwhelm the politics, too. I mean, these are small towns and at the perimeter of our metro area, and they're not always equipped to deal with this kind of a big project. And, you know, we're dealing with growth all over the region, but in most places we experience it incrementally. But in Black Diamond, we experienced it all at once.
Is there a lesson in all of this, Joshua?
I think there is. I mean, this project was so big. And it was big because it was planning for 20, 30 years into the future, right? It was saying, what if we could influence the shape of growth for decades to come and plan for it so that it was integrated, so that the roads actually went through instead of in these other housing developments elsewhere where there's all these cul-de-sacs and you can't get anywhere. And yet the scale was also its biggest enemy. Because it was so big and because we planned for it for so long, it took so long to implement that by the time we broke ground on the first foundations, the people who had started out with the idea and started out with a vision were retired or moved on to other cities.
Yeah, that was another generation that had that vision originally.
That's right.
So it left people with basically the same grief, but different expressions. There are the people who really wish the development could be smaller, and they're putting their energy into seeing if that can happen. And then others are taking their grief and saying, all right, is there any way that we can make this much larger version of Black Diamond still feel like Black Diamond to us? And that's, you know, an experiment that's going to continue. Like, we're leaving them to it. We're moving on to the next place.
Yes, you're leaving Black Diamond to their struggles and their challenges and their opportunities while you report someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready? Are you ready to leave Black Diamond?
I'm ready for a shorter commute to the next assignments.
I think so.
Okay, so you're headed south now to Renton and Kent and Auburn. Why are you going there?
Well, we're going there because it's increasingly become an attractive place to live as points north of there get really expensive. And there's a sort of a sense of community that's getting stronger there. And so we want to find out more about that. We're also interested in, you know, African Americans who've been displaced from the CD and elsewhere, you know, going there. It's also a place for refugees and immigrants. How are they finding the cost of living there? It's also a great place for manufacturing jobs, a huge hub, actually. Right now, though, a lot of the people who work in this area are coming in from other places. They don't get to live in Renton, Kent, and Auburn. So does this point to a disconnect between the wages that are being paid there and the cost of living? We're exploring.
Yeah, and one of the things we're wondering is there a tension between these two visions for this area that we're kind of jokingly calling it Ren-Ken-Burn, which is Renton, Kent, and Auburn, because when you consider all those manufacturing areas together, they're kind of like one big, giant manufacturing area. But we're wondering if there's a tension between this vision for this place about jobs and growth and, you know, sort of a higher tech version of manufacturing, and this idea that maybe so many people are moving out of the Central District in Seattle that it's becoming a sort of hub for African-American community, and then it's already kind of a hub for many immigrants. And we're wondering, are these two visions in tension or can they be there together? And, you know, one thing we lost in the Central District in Seattle, there used to be some manufacturing jobs there. There was that Wonder Bread factory. And now the Wonder Bread sign is on top of an apartment building. And so could Ren-Ken-Burn be the place where these things come together again, where there's affordable housing and jobs?
Yeah.
That's our growth reporting team, the region of boom, and two of our reporters are Joshua McNichols and Carolyn Adolph. On to Ren-Ken-Burn, and we're looking forward to your reporting. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
President Trump is expected to sign a bill making it easier for states to require drug testing for recipients of unemployment benefits. Does drug testing save the government money? We'll get into that this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. President Trump dropped a budget proposal recently that has a lot of implications for Seattle. Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton says the cuts to the National Institutes of Health, that's what concerns him the most.
Their funding to the tune of tens of millions of dollars is a backbone of the Puget Sound area biomedical and biotech sector and cluster. Especially at the University of Washington, which is either at the top or near the top of public universities in receiving National Institutes of Health grants. And then in general, there is the Trump war on science that affects all funding that comes into the Puget Sound region. And I might add, in addition to UW, you've got Fred Hutch, you've got Children's Hospital. It's a big deal.
Will you give us one example of how NIH money is the backbone of the Seattle area's biomedical industry?
Well, this starts with benchside research. So a researcher puts in for a grant for a promising cure or a promising therapy, and it's carried through sometimes over years, but then it can be commercialized with a biotech company here, and it's called bench to bedside. So this is the thing that makes us one of the top biomedical clusters in the country, and we have been for some time.
So what happens if that federal National Institutes of Health funding, that kind of grant funding, for example, if that goes away, what's it like here in the Seattle region?
Well, there is the risk of a loss of talent that researchers have to go somewhere else and start to rebuild from scratch where they can get funding. Maybe they can get it replaced here, but it's unlikely because ever since President Eisenhower, the federal government has played an enormous role in funding scientific research, including health research. And so we lose talent, and then we lose infrastructure with that. We lose the commercialization of the research, and so that hurts our ability to do startups. It hurts our ability to attract new talent here, new researchers, and it damages the ability to bring cures and therapies to people who need them.
Right. Beyond our local economy, there's the whole diseases being cured thing.
Exactly.
With some of Trump's budget cuts, the White House is saying, look, you want a local transit project? You pay for it. Is medical research something private industry could fund?
Not like this. For one thing, private industry funds for profit, not for basic science, not for the public good. And the whole notion of you want a local transit project, you fund it. This goes against all modern American history, where we have a public good that is recognized by Washington. Remember, we could have had a subway here if we hadn't turned it down in the late 1960s. And so if we're going to turn around and go back to the Coolidge administration, then we're going to pay a price. We're going to become a backward nation.
But we have such philanthropic and science-oriented powerhouses here, John. I mean, Paul Allen is funding medical research left and right, just for one example. Does that hold us in any different stead here?
Well, it holds us in different stead than Mesa, Arizona, or Tulsa, Oklahoma. But it certainly does not help with the federal government severely reducing its footprint here. So yes, we're very fortunate to have these civic stewards. They can't pick up the slack. And as far as the pharmaceutical industry in general, it spends so much money on marketing and things like that that has nothing to do with research, that it can't and is unwilling to pick up the slack because it's all about funneling money upwards to the shareholders.
Now, we're just talking about an early Trump budget proposal. Now comes the lobbying and the negotiating and the vote counting. Will industry and Congress lobby these cuts away?
Well, they'll lobby against them, but it shows a trajectory. Remember, Republicans are in total control of everything. And so that means that the trajectory will be to cut, cut, cut. And it may not be as severe as this, but it won't be adding funding where it's needed.
Well, let the lobbying begin. We'll watch it with you, John Talton, the Seattle Times economics columnist. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Bill.
And that's KUOW's The Record. I thank you for listening. The part that you missed lives on. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get yours. I'm Bill Radke. Talk to you tomorrow.
This is KUOW. It's 101.